episode is brought to you by Letterboxd's BAFTA and Oscar ballots. Get your at-home betting pool sorted with our bespoke, beautiful ballots.
The Letterboxd BAFTA and Oscar ballots are available right now at our Best in Show HQ, letterboxd.com/awards. Download them now for your at-home BAFTA and Oscar viewing party needs. Mia, did you once win a trophy at an at-home Oscars viewing party?
I did. I predicted the most Academy winners correctly in 2022 on account of I am blessed with supernatural clairvoyance powers, just like Madame Webb. And now, on with the show. This week on Best in Show, we pull up a table at the Oscars luncheon, give Jason Schwartzman an award, and dive into the magic of visual effects with the creators. And war is over. We wish. Hello, and welcome to Best in Show, a limited podcast series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I am Mia Livaccino, the West Coast editor here at Letterboxd, and Best in Show is all about award season. We meet contenders from this year's movies, interrogate insiders about the film ecosystem, and we look into that Letterboxd data. But mostly, we do what we always do here at Letterboxd. Celebrate cinema. And joining me to celebrate cinema are my Best in Show besties, a Hollywood veteran and our editorial producer, Brian Formo.
Ayo.
And our editor-in-chief, Gemma Gracewood.
What is up?
Whew. Gemma, we got a big, full, exciting show today. That is what's up. This week, we are taking you all behind the curtain of movie magic with the creators behind The Creator, which nabbed BAFTA and Oscar nominations for visual effects. And we talk to Sean Lennon and his War is Over collaborators who have an Oscar nomination for animated short.
And I am dying to hear all about your day poolside at the Oscars luncheon. Brian, Mia, you were there with the whole Letterboxd crew. It looked pretty fancy. I can't believe nobody jumped in that pool. But first, Brian, rumor has it, even before that, you gave out an award this week on behalf of Best in Show and indeed the entire Letterboxd community.
Yeah, it's more responsible to the entire Letterboxd community who made Jason Schwartzman, in the 11th hour, I might add, the most watched actor in our most recent annual year in review for his work for Across the Spider-Verse, Asteroid City, Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, among, you know, forever favorites like Rushmore and Marie Antoinette. Gotta get that in there. But we were all very, very delighted to see that he had won because Ryan Gosling had it all year. And it was everyone just gobbling up those Hunger Games at the end of the year on Letterboxd, pushed Jason Schwartzman over the top. And he was extremely, extremely grateful.
And maybe the Scott Pilgrim Takes Off miniseries that he's also in, that came out near the end of the year as well, right? That could have also, I don't want to erase Scott Pilgrim. He was fantastic in that.
I mean, Jason Schwartzman doesn't miss. He's hit after hit after hit.
So, that's right.
But we finally connected with him to deliver our doorstop, our murder weapon of a trophy in return. Here's his lovely acceptance speech. Acceptance speech to you, probably.
In fact, when I heard about this, I maybe thought it was some type of prank. And then when I found out that it wasn't, I think I was a bit in shock because, there are so many movies, there are so many actors, there are so many things in this world that to somehow have gotten filtered down to be the most of any of these things is quite overwhelming and meaningful, especially when it comes from this community, the Letterboxd community, because it's my people. I feel like it's people who love movies and love movies enough to have a collection of them in a way, and to care about them enough to recommend them and to write them down when someone else does and to talk about it and to give your opinion about it. It's that's kind of the most meaningful thing to me about the award is that that's who it's coming from. I sent this to my mom. I said, look, I did this. Because I thought, you know, finally, so, you know, there's my volleyball trophy from seventh grade. And now this, you know, and they're not really bookends because this is way heavier. So any books that we have on it would definitely topple the most improved player from 1993. She just wrote back, and I love you.
Oh, we love, love, love you too, Jason. Whew. Well, the awards march continues with the Oscars luncheon, which is when the Academy Awards class of 2024 get together for a big old class photo, elementary school style, and they also get a nice lunch.
And a certificate of completion of being an Oscar nominee. It's kind of funny to see them all carry around their certificates afterward. It's basically like a high school graduation.
It's so funny because one of the things that one of our other colleagues, Aaron, said looking at the photo was, it's weird when you get a whole lot of really fancy film people like that in one photo. They suddenly just look like regular, normal people. Normal people, you know, like it really does look like a school photo. It's so funny. But like, what's it like on the ground? Because we've heard about this situation at the Hilton with the pool and the cabanas and these little interview slots and people walking around with their certificates. We were there. What was the vibe? More importantly, who got to pet Snoop the dog, who plays Messi in Anatomy of a Fall? I need to know. And was he just glorious?
Yes. Oh my God. Messi was the star of the show. Like that was I almost called him a nominee. He is regrettably not a nominee, but he should be. No, but all of the actual nominees were like flocking to him. I saw Emma Stone talking about him and like getting starstruck. It was so funny. I too was very starstruck. He had like this little red bone toy that people would play fetch with him with. It was so sweet. And then I watched him take a little nap next to Emma Stone and Mark Ruffalo as they did an interview. And I was just like completely heart eyes at him. Regrettably, I did not get to pet him at the luncheon, but 2 days later, I did get to interview him. And that will be dropping soon.
Should we shatter the illusion of the class photo? Because it's so fun to think of them all standing on bleachers together, but they just get up one at a time or a couple at a time, like four at a time. And then they all get like photoshopped in together. So
Gemma,
to break the news.
Are you shattered?
I mean, look, AJ, when our editor...
Visual effects.
When our editor AJ came on here a few weeks ago and said, hey, you guys, guess what? One shot movies are not one shot. I think, like, any more illusions I might have had about Hollywood were shattered in that moment. So, like, that's a lot of people and a lot of famous people and a lot of famous people who really like what they and each other do to get to stop talking to each other about themselves and each other for a long time. So I am not surprised they do it in chunks. Not surprised at all.
Well, to Aaron's point about they're just normal people, I had the funny moment of kind of surveying across the pool, seeing who was out there, but these shoes across the way really caught my attention. They were beautiful sneakers, and I just watched the sneakers walk the length of the pool, and then I looked up and saw that it was Robert Downey Jr. So I was about, that guy's sneakers game is amazing. Oh, wait, that's Iron Man. But speaking of shoes, we had the best shoes come into our tent.
I saw those photos. I need to know whose shoes they were. Please describe the shoes. Describe the shoes' owners.
They were Godzilla's claws at the back of all the Godzilla, like all the Godzilla Minus One cast and VFX people, including the director Takashi Yamazaki, who, like our guest on the show, Gareth Edwards, is started his career in visual effects before becoming a director. But he brought the whole gang, and they all had amazing shoes. I remember the publicist came up and they're like, "Look at the shoes," and it was very unassuming because in the front it was just a leather shoe. It was like, "Yes, those are nice shoes." And then you see the back, and jaws all dropped, and it was amazing. It was a good shoe reveal.
Like at this point in the Oscars game, with voting opening sort of late next week, you got to throw everything at it, right? Absolutely everything. And if a pair of shoes is going to tip Godzilla over the edge, why not?
Well, not only did they have those killer shoes, they also brought a couple of Godzilla action figures. So they had one, you know, just normal Godzilla. And then they had one where he's, you know, when he's like powered up with the blue spikes on the back and he's getting ready to do his power beam move. They had one of those as well. And before they came into the tent, they were like playing around with them at the pool and messing around and just like having a laugh. They were one of my most favorite interviews of the whole day. I love that crew. We also have a wonderful journal story up with the director himself. So take a look at that, if you please.
It's got shades of Guillermo del Toro and Dear Departed Matt Gustafson with, you know, Pinocchio and Geppetto maquettes last year. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering about the lunch and whether any fried chicken was served, because I did notice that a certain Oscars ambassador was brought in from the UK, none other than Amelia de Moldenberg of Chicken Shop Date was there.
Yes.
Vibes.
And funnily enough, Brian and I both had fried chicken for lunch.
Why? I introduced Mia to chicken schnitzel, and then Mia introduced all of us to
yes.
Amelia de Moldenberg, Chicken Shop Date.
It's true. We were introducing chickens all over the place at that luncheon. So yes, she is the Oscars ambassador this year, and a highlight was definitely meeting her. I love all of her interviews. We got to queen out over how she just watched Music and Lyrics, and I accidentally was like screaming at her, like, I've seen it 15 times, I love it so much. So it was lovely to meet her. We got her four faves. That's a hot tip for everybody who listens to Best in Show. You'll know ahead of time. We got her four faves.
But did you get her on Winner Chicken Run Dinner? I mean, you know, that's the ultimate goal.
Oh,
right?
I forgot to book her for Winner Chicken Run Dinner. There's still time.
There is still time.
There is still time. Amelia, come on Winner Chicken Run Dinner sometime. It seems tailor-made for you.
We'll just do it at the Oscars.
I gave her a producer my card. This is what I do. I give everyone my card at these things. This is what you do.
Yeah.
I want to know why nobody jumped in that pool. Is it like just off limits because it says Oscar inside it? Or is it just that nobody's prepared to get in a swimsuit while other media outlets' cameras are trained on them?
I actually think Wim Wenders pointed it out. It's cooler to not go in the pool because there was a sign right by our tent that said, life is better by the pool.
What?
And he was obsessed with that sign. He took like 22 pictures in front of it. Everywhere he was going, he just kept saying it to people. So maybe that was a way to keep people from going in, is because it's cooler to be outside of it.
I'm glad I wasn't there.
Thank you, Wim Wenders.
I would have embarrassed you so much. As a New Zealander, it's basically national law that if there's a pool, you must jump in it.
Yes, I was very, very tempted because it was starting to get hot in the afternoon. Annette Bening walked by us and she was so close to the edge of the pool. And I kept thinking in my head, I could push her in and she could naiad her way out of there, no problem. Like, she should go naiad mode and jump in that dang pool.
With a Godzilla chasing her, I mean.
Yes, with the Godzillas. The Godzilla naiad crossover.
I'm waiting for it. Oscar in the bag.
Where is it?
Speaking of Oscar in the bag, in terms of the Oscar luncheon and its place in the, I guess, more the voting profile than the Academy just getting everyone together for a class photo and having a nice time before it all gets competitive on the night. I'm really interested in what this year's vibe was around that and around the kind of, I guess, the sort of happy groups of film families that we've been used to seeing these past few years.
This is my fourth Oscar luncheon, and it was actually quite uniquely different in a somewhat detrimental way, I think, to like seeing what you're talking about of like outside of like the Godzilla minus one entire group, there wasn't these families representing films, walking around everywhere. In the years past, Oscar luncheon has always been very revealing to me about who fellow nominees are really excited to see. You can see it on their face, and they like follow them around, and those all become a lot of those have become the eventual Best Picture winners. Because it's always been a group that created excitement and reminded people about the movie they love. There was the Parasite family all together. There was the EEAO family all together. There was the Coda family. This year, There are actual giant movies that the Oscars are a coronation of the already earned success. There wasn't really anyone giving the underdog warm fuzzies, except for Mezzi the dog.
The literal underdog.
I think that there kind of is always like a mascot at this, and the Anatomy of a Fall team seized on that, and it's already paying dividends. I'm seeing it everywhere on Instagram. So I think that was something. Because there wasn't the normal amount of star power, because basically, with the exception of America Ferrera, Barbie skipped this. But you know what they didn't skip doing? Barbie skipped doing promo at the Oscar luncheon because they've already done all the promo. They've made $1 billion, but they did drop a promo the next day for the Oscars, because the Oscars can actually lean on the popular films that are nominated this year instead of the A-listers having to do all these press junkets to do it for them.
So I guess we leave. The luncheon poolside and we enter Barbie Land, where we find Jimmy Kimmel and ABC's very expensive, at least expensive looking, very Barbie heavy Oscars promo. Seemed like they gave really short shrift to Past Lives, Zone of Interest, American Fiction, even The Holdovers, surprisingly, even though it's a comedy, because it's almost like they didn't know how to make comedy of these other sort of difficult or intellectual films.
I think it's more kind of what I was saying before, that those are the films that are typically nominated for Oscars, that people who maybe dismiss the Oscars, they associate those types of films with being Oscar nominated. So they really wanted to play up like, we also have like Barbie fun and like Oppenheimer. All of you watch those movies. Forget about these little ones over here. And that's what I think they were doing. They knew exactly what they were doing.
On the other hand, it is so nice to see Kate McKinnon back as Weird Barbie. I will take a Kate McKinnon Weird Barbie skit anytime, day or night. And she has some great lines, you know, on the map, take a Jeffrey Wright here. I feel like maybe the entire promo was built off the fact that they wanted to figure out how to get a Kenard Bernstein gag in there in relation to Bradley Cooper. Yeah, I liked that.
I liked the Killers of the Flower Moon goggles.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I have to say for positives.
I didn't even catch that. I did not even catch that.
And, you know, again, always very happy to have Ryan back as Ken anytime. But sad not to see Alan in this promo. However, all is not lost.
He was busy.
Michael Cera was busy this week. What was he doing, Mia?
Michael Cera Cerave, he was stealing the freaking show, just like Messi at the Oscars luncheon. He was in this hilarious Cerave commercial. It's for lotion, and it is actually the kind that I use.
Oh my gosh.
It's true. And Michael Cera, comedy genius that he is, he actually pitched this to the great Tim and Eric. That is Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim of the Tim and Eric Show, which I've seen a billion times. They are alternative comedy legends, and this was the commercial of the night for me.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It looked good. I will say finally that I do think the ABC promo for the Oscars looked good. You know, it was really fun to go through that, you know, weird journey from Barbie Land to Oscars Land via Killers of the Italians Moon's Land. It looked good. You know, they threw a lot of money at it. They got all the right actors. It looked great. Great effects.
Great visual effects. We can all agree on that.
We can all agree on that, which is very handy given that this is a visual effects focused episode, which I think means it's time, isn't it, Mia? Is it time?
Shall we step behind that curtain?
The visual effects category at the Oscars has been strange and unpredictable. It's also an aspect of filmmaking that I don't truly understand that well. That's why I interviewed the people that you're going to hear later. It's been an on and off award since the Academy Awards began, when Wings, I brought that up on a previous podcast.
Yes, it was your chicken dinner.
Yeah, that was one of my din-dins. Wings won a Best Engineering Effects Prize in 1929, in addition to Best Picture, the first Best Picture ever. It finally got the current title of Best Visual Effects in 1977, which was for which was for Star Wars. Fun fact, Stanley Kubrick's only competitive Oscar was for visual effects as well in 1968 for 2001, A Space Odyssey, where actually it wasn't...
Yeah, that tracks.
Some years there were three nominees. Some years there was just one, like the 2001 Space Odyssey year that I just mentioned. In 1990, there were no official nominees, but Total Recall, my boy Paul Verhoeven, well, he didn't get it, but the film got a special achievement Oscar as a kind of backup prize. They always love to do makeup prizes at the Oscars, always. All right, and I don't necessarily mean makeup.
Yeah, I see what you mean. But makeup had a similar journey, didn't it, as well, where it was sort of, you know, took a while for that acknowledgement of the prosthetics and special effects. And I think, you know, what's happened since, obviously, is that technology has come a really long way. And so this year, like the last several decades, there are consistently 5 finalists, and they're usually films that have come out of the massive special effects production houses. This year, the Oscar finalists are Godzilla Minus One, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, Napoleon, those Guardians of the Galaxy, third time round, and The Creator. The BAFTAs have pretty much the same finalists, except that they've swapped out Godzilla for, of all things, Poor Things, which is wild. But then again, those freaky Poor Things hybrid freaky animals need some love for VFX, because who doesn't want like a goose dog in their backyard?
Okay, you know what, y'all? I'm still kind of hung up on the fact that Kubrick only won one Oscar and it was for visual effects. That was a really wild fact to me. So I have some more facts. And this one, you know what? It's not as fun. It's going to bring us all down a little bit.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so yeah, brace yourselves. Whew. According to the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, which we will have a link to in the episode notes, only 5 women have ever been nominated for Oscars in visual effects. And the first nomination...
What?
I know. Well, hold on. The first nomination only came in 1986 for Suzanne M. Benson, who won as part of the Aliens team.
Well, good for her, but
and now we can all go, what?
What?
Huh? What?
Good for Suzanne. But that is,
yes,
like, that is a wild statistic. I mean, I got a lot of friends in the compositing and background landscape industry. And a lot of them are women. And as any of the 70,000 million animators and compositors and layout artists and CG supervisors and riggers and, you know, and every other type of department within visual effects knows, a visual effects Oscar is not just for the people who collect the trophy. It's for the whole team. But, you know, so there are a lot of women recognized, I'm guessing, by the Oscars that have been won. But it's about the name on the trophy, right? And that is about the leadership roles. And that 5 women, that's a really rude reminder of how hard it is to get those Oscar-tier job titles, even though effects houses are stacked full of women running departments. That's crazy.
It is. But at least we're making a little bit of headway. The 5th nomination for a woman in visual effects came this year with Kyoko Shibuya, the first Asian woman and the first woman of color to be nominated, along with her Godzilla Minus One team. Okay, give it up for that. First woman of color. Woohoo! It only took until 2024. Cool. Yeah, unfun fact. But here's a fun fact to even it out, okay? That film's budget was only around $15 million. Huh? That's another huh from me, because you would not guess that from watching that film.
No, like, way.
Those effects are incredible.
I tell you what else you wouldn't guess. $80 million, that is what the creator's overall budget was. I mean, that actually sounds like heaps. It's definitely more than I've got in my pocket. But $80 million is still teeny compared to Dead Reckoning and Guardians of the Galaxy and Napoleon. Those all cost $200 million or more, much more. And I think for that money, the creator actually looks incredible. But I was reading about how director Gareth Edwards has said he's embarrassed by the price tag and that he thinks they could have made it even cheaper. It's just wild to me. But God, that's a good looking film.
Yeah, it's a great looking film, and part of the secret in that sauce is going to a beautiful place as opposed to just shooting on a soundstage. And more people should try that, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's give a hearty shout out to the creator's women department heads, Charmaine Chan, Woo! Catherine Farrar Bluff.
Yeah, yeah. Woo.
Yeah, yeah. And Danielle Legovich of Industrial Light and Magic. We see you and we love your work.
Indeed. So many people work so hard on this film. A lot of people have to work very hard to make something look this good for under $80 million if it's a futuristic sci-fi movie. It was shot on location without the usual green screen soundstage tricks. And I got to speak with Gareth Edwards and VFX nominee Andrew Roberts. Now, back to the point of odd distinctions, Andrew Roberts is nominated for an Oscar for the creator team, but he is not nominated for a BAFTA, despite the film being nominated for a BAFTA. So there's a lot of weird, tricky things in this space. So he was especially very, very grateful to be nominated. And I know that Gareth felt vindicated by their pair of Oscar nominations. Take a listen.
There's lots of reasons you might make a movie, but if someone had said to me, at the end of this movie, you're going to get like two Oscar nominations and, you know, one of them is going to be for visual effects, I woke up the neighbors when they announced it at 5 a.m. I was shouting and screaming and jumping up and down. I was so happy for everyone. We did go about this in a very different way. It was a massive ask from Industrial Light and Magic and all the other vendors that worked on the film. It was a big leap of faith. We did kind of work backwards and didn't have green screen really or tracking markers and all the normal, you know, rigmarole and motion capture suits that you have on these sort of movies. And we shot it very guerrilla, like in the Himalayas and in like volcanoes in Indonesia and Tokyo, the streets of Tokyo and Bangkok. And just to try and get this very realistic, like naturalistic behavior of people and environments, knowing that we were going to then like basically cut everything out and stick the science fiction on top in post-production. And it took a real leap of faith. And so I feel like a nomination, I'm just a very proud dad right now.
Yeah. Well, it's totally fitting that and appropriate that you be taking credit for this, Gareth, and that you're here with us during this press day and here with Letterboxd, because you were absolutely integral to every aspect of the visual effects. Having that familiarity and understanding of the process and having worked as an artist, I think then really informed from pre-production those discussions that we had when myself and our overall suit, Jay Cooper, and the rest of the team were having our pre-pro walkthroughs and talking about those main action sequences and how they would be executed. Then Gareth's understanding of visual effects and us talking through what we would be able to shoot versus what we would be able to handle in post really made a huge difference.
Let's back up a little bit. Andrew already mentioned that. So Gareth, you have a background in visual effects. Let's go back to the beginning. Can you just walk us through your career jump and how your visual effects background led to directing and how you think maybe that's something that more directors should do?
I guess when I was growing up, you know, all my heroes had got into filmmaking through different paths. Like obviously some people, you know, you try to just pick up a camera and go make short films and then you get offered a big directing gig. Like it feels like people like Spielberg did that kind of thing. I tried the same thing, but unfortunately, Hollywood didn't return my calls. And I was like, oh God, what am I going to do now? I've made a massive mistake. And it just so happened, my flatmate at film school was studying this brand new thing called computer animation. And Jurassic Park had just come out in the cinema and it was clearly the future of filmmaking. So I thought, okay, I'm going to buy a computer. I'm just going to learn this software. And in 6 months, I'm going to go make a movie with it. And cut to about 15 years later, I'm still learning the software because it's way harder than you give it credit. And then eventually managed to transfer that in my first film. I reached a dotted line in the sand and went, you know what, I'm going to stop and I'm just going to go make a film now with my own money. And I was lucky I got given some money, very, very low budget film, and did the visual effects myself on it. And it was, I thought I'd wasted 15 years of my life, but it turned out, to reference Karate Kid, it turned out to be the wax on, wax off of filmmaking. You do this laborious task, and when you're basically, when you get a shot wrong in the computer or doing visual effects, you've wasted at least a day minimum, maybe a week, you know, depends on how long it takes you to do a shot, but at least a whole day you've wasted. So you learn really painfully what makes a good shot, like what composition, lighting, all sorts of things. Like it gets really ingrained in you because it's so, you get so punished when you get it wrong. And so then when I got to pick up a camera and make a film, it was so liberating because suddenly all those rules that you subconsciously knew about composition and photography, you could quickly, like I wanted to put a little sticker on the camera saying real-time renderer, you know, because you could quickly move around and get, you know, take 5 seconds to change a shot. And it was an amazing thing. And I think as a filmmaker now looking back, I'm kind of glad I went that path because visual, in terms of the films I want to make, which is science fiction and, you know, genre, visual effects is probably the most like mystical technology involved in that kind of filmmaking. Most people understand the camera, basically. Most people understand storytelling. But computer graphics, you know, I was saying even CGI, the term CGI is computer generated imagery. Even that is wrong. Like it suggests that computers generate images and it's people, you know, it's artists. And like you don't call footage from a camera, camera generated imagery, you know, and things like this. And so there's this whole like black arts, like, you know, mystical element to visual effects that I hope one thing you can bring to the table if you're a VFX background filmmaker is when you divide up the pie of, okay, so what are we going to have in front of camera? And what are we going to do in post-production with you know, with computer graphics and VFX artists? That divide, I hope, is a lot more sensible. And I felt the whole way through my career as a filmmaker that it'd always been the wrong divide. And that the better divide was, let's go to real places, shoot real things, compose real shots with people really there, and then like rotoscope and digitally augment all the science fiction on top afterwards. And it feels at the other end of this now that feels good to me. Like it feels like if I get to make another film, we're definitely going to do it this way. Like there's no going back to green screen in studios anymore for me, I think.
Andrew, one thing that I wanted to ask as like an onset visual effects supervisor, like what details are you paying attention to deliver to the post-production team? And then also just like if you could speak to how this experience, because, you know, we are... When we picture modern day visual effects, we think of like a soundstage in London, Budapest, Atlanta, whatnot with a green screen. So like how is this experience different for you? And what were you looking for that was maybe different to send back to the post team?
There was something incredibly liberating about being on a location, even though it might have been inconvenient getting up at 3 a.m. or traveling 2 hours in a van to get to a remote location. You arrive there and then there's so much information that you can capture, and you've got the texture, you've got just a unique lighting, the way that the light is dappling through the leaves overhead if we're in more of a jungle location, or the harsh bounce sort of off of a more of a quarry, and the way that that lighting is something that you're really not going to be able to recreate in more of a studio setting. And so that was great. It was gold to be able to, you know, put my drone up and then try and get some aerial reference and then walk around just taking tons of photos, knowing that this is going to be great inspiration and a great sort of launching off point for the team. In terms of how I would approach any given shot, we would use Qtake, the remote monitoring software, where, you know, everyone's got their phone or their iPad up and they're able to just see how Gareth is framing and what he's shooting. So based on that, and knowing that, okay, Alfie is in this scene, played by Madeline Voiles, then we know that she's a simulant, or if Ken Watanabe, who plays Haroon, if he's in frame, we know they're a simulant. I know that I'm going to need to try and get some reflectance information. So we did have a chrome ball and chart for the reference spheres. I tried to grab a clean plate whenever I could. And I say whenever I could because this was a small guerrilla team. It was very run and gun, where there wasn't a whole lot of time. We couldn't sort of have everyone wait either 20, 30 minutes for me to capture everything I needed. I might just be able to go in and triage, get the one most important thing that I felt that the team would need. And I would base that on my experience as I started off as a 3D generalist before getting into CG Soup and then being an on-set and visual effects supervisor. So thinking back to the kind of tools, if I was executing a shot, what kinds of information would be most helpful to me? So that was generally how I was approaching it, looking at, okay, Gareth has shot that. Let me grab the FX3 from him once he's cut and he's finished with his actors and try and shoot a tile or get a clean plate or capture, you know, sort of a 360. And then note that down for the team as to what I was able to get. So I think difference from sort of a studio or a set is, to sort of the realism of really being there, real things that you can capture to pass on to the team. And you would see that in the actors, that they've got something really to sort of vibe off of and react to and act against. So there was a level of realism to their emotions, just being in this village or at the beach, for the romantic scenes between John David and Gemma Chan, that you may not have gotten if you're just in more of a sterile, environment, just with surrounded with blue and green. It was great that we weren't just kicking the can and saying, we'll put that up and we'll decide what it is later. We'll put some green up and figure it out later. That those decisions had been made in advance, that we know that we want to be in this location. It's going to be a whole bunch of production design and design refinement later, but we are making a take. We're putting a stake in the sand as to this is where this should be, and we'll build on top of it. So I really enjoyed being on location and being in those real places where we just captured realism.
Part of what you said there was actually a good segue to my next question. So within our interviews, we call it behind the curtain. We want to invite our cinephile membership to kind of learn more about filmmaking. And I think VFX is something that is very not known to our audience. And so I went through, I just pulled a credit for each of you from past jobs that you have done. And I was wondering if you could, I'll say what the job was or what the title was and what the film title was and what the job you did on it. If you could explain what that is to our audience. So Gareth, on In the Shadow of the Moon, under VFX, you're credited as Digital Rostrum. What is Digital Rostrum?
It's actually, so that's a friend of mine made that film, and I think it got into Sundance, and they were like, oh, we don't have a poster. So, and I was like probably the only person who knew who did Photoshop. So I was like, so I did this poster quickly for them, and I was quite proud of it and gave it to them, and that was that. And then they were finishing the movie, and they had... So Rostrum is, I think you call it in America, is it Ken Morse or something? Is that right, Andrew?
I'm not sure what the American phrase is, yeah.
In the UK, it's called Rostrum Moves. And it's basically, when you watch a documentary and they'll show still photographs, but it won't be boring, just a still. The camera zoom in and it'll travel over the image. So that's a Rostrum camera. It's basically like a robotic camera. But I was doing it in the computer, very cheaply. I just did it as a favor for a friend. I never expected to get an IMDb credit for it. But yeah, it's obviously the pinnacle of my career is that I did some photographs in After Effects.
And then Andrew, on Babylon, you're created as a plate supervision. What does a plate supervisor do?
Right. So a plate will refer to footage, the original material that is filmed. And the overall supervisor for the creator was also the overall visual effects supervisor for Babylon, Jay Cooper. And so there were locations that I went to with him where I was helping capture background information. I was scanning, just trying to just get as much info as possible for footage that then the team would be able to use for the opening scene where we see them in the... They're transporting the elephant to the party, and we're sort of out in these fields trying to capture sort of the visuals, the high dynamic range imagery, 360 degrees, to be able to use to relight the digital elephant. And then when we're at Paramount Studios later, doing LiDAR scans and then just capturing footage that then again will be used as a background plate and imagery. That was my role for that film.
Do you still hang out with Brad Pitt? Andrew?
I mean, just when I have time. I mean,
you're busy, right?
Yeah, I'm a busy man. Yeah.
I mean, the film The Creator was released during a writer and actor strike, and many of the main areas of protection that actors and writers and directors, they just got a deal done earlier, were about AI. And obviously this film was written and made before OpenAI and all of that. Wanted to know, you know, because the film in the end is kind of trying to find a balance between humans and AI. And how do you see that within your professions as the best way to go?
I think there's, however anybody answers that kind of question right now, you play it back in 2 or 3 years, you're going to look like an idiot. Like, it's really hard to predict how this is going to play out. Nobody honestly knows, not even the people designing this stuff. I think what is fair to say is it's going to be a tool, an incredible tool. It might well change filmmaking, you know, in a way that's like beyond computer graphics and digital technology did. I would say, trying to just look on the bright side of it, if I was a young aspiring filmmaker today, I'd be super excited. Like, I think the tools that are around the corner are going to be incredible and mind-blowing. They're already, like, when you think about where it was at a year ago and what you're seeing now, you know, little demos of things that are happening already, it's mind-blowing stuff. And I from my point of view, what we tried to do on this film was, we tried to make a very aspirational, epic, you know, no holds barred blockbuster for a lot less money. And the reason we were trying to do it is not to be cheap, but if you do it for less money, you get more creative freedom because there's not such a financial risk. And if there are tools or ways of making films where people aren't limited with their imagination, but they can be braver creatively because there's not so much money at stake, I think that's a great thing for cinema. I think something needs to change, right? We're in a bit of a rut. It's not, we're not in the greatest period of all of, you know, film history right now. I think a lot of people would agree. And so we'll see what happens, but I'm trying to be on the positive side of it. And mainly because when there is the robo apocalypse and they come for everybody, I'm going to be spared because I made a film that was very empathetic to AI.
Sympathetic.
And I'm allowed a plus one. And if Andrew invites me to the Oscars, then he'll be my plus one that gets saved by the AI overlords.
That sounds like a good deal. That sounds like a great deal. I was thinking of the Light and Magic documentary that talks about the growth and the origins of industrial light and magic. And as we think about, you know, machine learning and these tools, it just reminded me of when we had that transition from special effects to digital effects. And it was a huge seismic shift where, you know, people had to retrain and some people were like, oh my goodness, you know, what is this going to mean? But then it ended up being a tool that a number of people could use their experiences and use their skills from when they were working with physical sets and apply that. And some of the best artists have that background as traditional artists or model makers in order to then use take the visual effects to the next level. And so I think, you know, with sort of this software that gets trained on other experiences, I personally don't think that it's going to take the place of artists. I mean, my parents are from the Caribbean. I was born in the UK. The majority of my career has been in the United States. And so I have a very unique background. I think there's a value in the diversity that comes from being behind the camera or being artists that work on the box, and that we bring sort of our unique background and the diversity into the work that can't be replaced by machines just sort of scraping and learning from other people's experiences. So I think there's always going to be a place for artists.
Now, Andrew, you just go to settings, Caribbean. New York, and control...
Control
Alpha London.
I agree, Andrew, and AI cannot replace the uniqueness of artists in this world like John Lennon and Yoko Ono, which brings us to our third interview today, if we're including Jason Schwartzman, just to really dig in to a little bit more in the visual effects realm before we finish up this week. War Is Over is one of the year's Oscar-nominated short films, and for a short, it has major feature film energy and a lot of awards pedigree behind it. Director and co-writer Dave Mullins also directed the 2017 Oscar-nominated Pixar short, Lou. He was with Pixar for a good couple of decades. Producer Brad Booker, before he was a producer, he was a senior animator on Peter Jackson's smash hit and very Oscar-winning Lord of the Rings trilogy. And those connections led to the War is Over team asking Peter Jackson and Weta FX to get involved, along with James Cameron's Lightstorm Entertainment. So with them and the Weta team, they used this particular short, War is Over, as an opportunity to test and prove some new visual effects toys. So it's, yeah, it's really interesting to see how one thing can lead to whatever the next big budget box office blockbuster hit that we're going to see.
Yes, yes, yes. And the title is, of course, inspired by Yoko Ono and John Lennon's epic song, Happy Christmas, parentheses, War is Over, which was released in 1971, 4 years before their son, Sean Lennon, came into this world. Sean is the film's co-writer, having rejected the record company's original idea for a music video. Instead, he created a story about soldiers across battle lines who play a game of chess using a carrier pigeon to communicate their moves.
Our New York correspondent, Julia Barrett Mitchell, who you have heard before on the show, she met Dave, Brad, and Sean at the Woodstock Film Festival when they premiered War is Over. At the same time, she was premiering her own very good short doc, 45 Degrees. So it seemed perfectly sensible to send Julia to reunite with them for a chat.
I swear when I remember this film being anywhere between an hour and a half and 3 hours long, I need to remember that's only 11 minutes because the magnitude of the anti-war message, the sheer stunning visuals of the animation, it's just truly blew me out of the water. So I get the privilege of saying I'm proud of you guys. From the moment I saw it, I knew it would be nominated for an Oscar, and I was right. Dave, I remember hearing at the Q&A for the premiere that you kind of conceptualized it in one night, or you like wrote, you were just so inspired that you sat down and wrote the whole first draft in one sitting.
You know, within a couple meetings, you know, we had the outline done. And so that night I'd kind of went home and like, okay, I'm going to write the script and like really flesh it out. And it was one of those really rare, great experiences where the writing came so easily. I think I wrote 10 pages that night, and then, you know, I think I showed it to you, Brad, the next day, and you got some notes, and we worked a little bit, and then the next day I sent it to Sean, and Sean, you seemed to really, you know, connect to it, and we were off to the races, like, almost so quickly. It was kind of crazy, because story never comes together like that, and it really did come together like that on this film.
Well, I really find the story structure of this 11-minute film just impeccable. So it's really interesting to hear about how it came together. Dave, you spoke a bit about your inspirations for this film that strangely weren't animated films. They were rather war films. Can you tell me a bit about that research and how those films influenced the film that you made?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when anything that like Brad and I do as Electrolake, like we heavily research anything that we're going to create or any, you know, we're in a World War One alternate setting. So we looked at a lot of different war films, you know, especially for the cinematography. You know, one of the things we looked at, the, you know, Band of Brothers has a fantastic show, but there's an episode, The Bastogne. I mean, that was sort of an example of something we were looking at. And we just felt like, you know, you have the pristine white snow, but you're in the black forest. But it's like these black explosions of black dirt would come up. And that was really inspiring to us, and looking at how the soldiers were dealing with their life in the trenches, you know.
Yeah, and don't forget because we had spoken about how we didn't want it to look like too polished, the visuals like a kind of family, you know, Pixar film. Those films I love, but we wanted more of a painterly style. And you, I think on maybe the third meeting we had, you gave a presentation of the color palette, and it was mostly inspired actually from these very beautiful World War One posters with these kind of muted greens and muted browns. And as soon as you brought that stuff out, I was so excited because I'm a big fan of, you know, that kind of antique graphic work from that time period. you know, I'm an artist too, an amateur artist, but I paint and I draw. And just seeing all the painterly stuff and what he's talking about, you mentioned Band of Brothers, actually, that idea of the way that the snow would be broken by the explosions. And they showed me, you know, actual paintings. The artist who did the painterly stuff for the textures, he had all these snow paintings and bomb smoke paintings. And they were working on just the look of the explosions and the snow and the scattered snow before we even shot anything. So it was incredible, because you'd think for an 11-minute film, maybe that kind of stuff would be overlooked. But to me, I mean, as an amateur coming to this, it felt like the kind of work that you would do if you were making like an epic trilogy of feature films or something. So there was a lot of love and thought put into every aspect of it.
Brad, I'm wondering if you could speak to the gorgeous, entirely digital visuals of this film and how, if you could take us through the creative process of creating those digital visuals.
Obviously, like Dave said, it all starts with the art team. So Zach Retz, our production designer, and Max Narciso, our character designer, had done this amazing foundation of you know, visual development. And you know, once Peter Jackson and David Connolly and Weta Effects got involved, then it was really, you know, and not only was it a challenge to put together something as, I think, creatively unique in terms of the visuals, but we were trying to do it in the Unreal Engine, because you know, everything Dave and I have been working towards is to build a real-time pipeline where we are using the Unreal Engine to capture performance on the stage and then use animators to go in and animate on top of that performance. So we were kind of challenged, you know, uniquely so, in that we were doing this all in a real-time game engine, which most of the time people use for more realistic applications or you know, if stylized, it falls in kind of more of a hyperreal. So to push into this painterly territory and using the kind of outline shaders, that was technically a challenge for even Weta. I mean, that, you know, obviously award-winning studio. They were working on Avatar alongside us getting going on this very talented, award-winning team, but this was a new pipeline that they were building. So we were kind of the test bed for that, a real-time pipeline, capturing stuff. You know, not only was Weta involved, we also lucked out and kind of through different relationships and the fact that Weta was already working with Lightstorm, we shot the whole thing on the Avatar stage in Manhattan Beach. So we're working with Weta, we're capturing on the Lightstorm stage, and together with those two kind of like technologically bleeding edge companies, we brought it into this amazing world.
Wow, it's incredible to hear that an 11-minute short film really pushed Weta's limits of what they could do technologically and artistically. That's quite a brag right that you have there. I would be remiss not to talk about the timing of this film coming out. I see it as not only such a beautiful anti-war film, but it was sort of a torch that was passed on to you, Sean, from your parents and spreading a message of peace. Of course, the film itself, the characters find themselves in this cruel war, but are also engaging in peacemaking and communicating a message of peace. And Dave, this is actually your second Oscar nomination. As Sean mentioned, you were nominated for your short film, Lou. But I'm wondering if you could all speak on the timing of this film coming out and this film getting recognition and being nominated for an Oscar at a time when we couldn't use an anti-war message more.
Yeah, well, there's a kind of terrible synchronicity in regards to all the wars that have been continuing and continuing to break out over the time period that we've been working on it. And, you know, for all of us, it's been chilling, actually, because, you know, it's not the kind of topic that you want to become relevant in terms of a contemporary real world story. But, you know, unfortunately, that is the case. And, you know, but obviously that makes the film have a special kind of resonance and gravitas that that it might not have. So there's something really profound from my perspective that, you know, a song my parents wrote in the early 70s feels more relevant than ever. And there's something very bittersweet about that. You know, I mean, it's really incredible that their work has that kind of timeless power.
Something else that has timeless power. Award-winning movies of history, of course. It is time for Winner Winner Chicken Run Dinner. As always, we finish off the episode with a dip into our diaries for a glimpse into award season's past. It has been a stacked show, so we're going to keep it short and sweet.
Yes, I was really feeling those visual effects women statistics. So I've looked in my diary and I can see that I watched a couple of weeks ago the Academy Award-winning animated stop-motion short film Peter and the Wolf. This is Susie Templeton's 2006 short. It's so wonderful. And Susie doesn't make enough movies, but rumor has it that she's been working on a new one for ages. But Peter and the Wolf, if you know the story, it's of course Sergei Prokofiev's wonderful music. And this is the story here. She treats slightly differently with the ending. It's a very effective kind of anti-bullying message in that basically, if you try to bully a sweet boy called Peter, he will go out and catch the scariest wolf in the forest and bring it into your town square. This film, however, has quite a different ending from Prokofiev's original. It's about victims recognizing victims and having empathy for those we would label as terrorists. It just really sat with me at this point in time. Or as James writes on Letterboxd, it's a heartfelt hymn to outsiders. Highly recommend it.
Ooh, we love when women use their empathy skills to make moving art, don't we, Gemma? Don't we? Well, my film that I watched was not made by a woman at all. It was There Will Be Blood, which is one of my favorite films of all time. I watched this on Super Bowl Sunday at my beloved Egyptian theater. It came with a career conversation with legendary production designer and David Lynch's bestie, Jack Fisk, who is currently nominated for his work on Killers of the Flower Moon. And I really kept thinking about throughout the film because they are both these great American epics about capitalistic greed and oil in the early 1900s. I can't believe I hadn't put together that connection that they are so related like that. But There Will Be Blood, what do you even say about this picture? It is incredible. I mean, I just checked. It has won 114 awards, including two Oscars, Best Actor for the Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, and Best Cinematography for Robert Elswit, if we recall. Mm-hmm. It did lose to No Country for Old Men. It did. But what a year for cinema to have those two films going up against each other, not to mention like also Juno, Michael Clayton. Okay, I'm going off script, sorry.
Well, also, I mean, because There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men shot in the same place at the same time. It's crazy.
Exactly. It really is. It really, really, really is. Ooh. So yeah, DDL was just sweeping that award season. I won't list all of the awards he won because that list would be 10 miles long. But rest assured, it was a clean sweep. He even got the coveted Clotrudis Award, as yes! We'll recall. Those are our favorite awards because they are cat-themed. And he deserved every single one of them for his delivery of Drainage, Eli Boy. Thank you. Where's my Oscar? Okay.
I know Daniel Day-Lewis is retired, but can we please have DDL and Javier Bardem in the same film just once before we die?
Lyle Crocodile 2. Lyle Crocodile 2. He'll come out of retirement for that.
Oh, no, and they will win Best Original Song, won't they?
I had a theme picked to that. Should we preview next week's episode? Can we say who the guest is?
Absolutely. Why would we hold out?
Could it perhaps be Billie Eilish and Phineas? Huh?
Amazing.
What?
It is. It's in the can. It is in the can. It is ready to be put out in the world next week. They are obviously promoing. They're winning as many awards as Daniel Day-Lewis for a Best Original Song from Barbie, What Was I Made For? So I went back in the annals of time and watched one of the bigger pop hits to have won Best Original Song, Arthur's Theme from Arthur. if Christopher you get caught crosses
between the moon and New York City.
There you go.
I know it's crazy.
People might not know the name, the song by its title, because it, let's be honest, it's a terrible title. but it is a hook-filled song. Those keyboards, Christopher Cross, smooth voice. It did win Best Original Song, but that's not the only award that Arthur won. It also won Best Supporting Actor for John Gielgud as well. Okay, so the movie itself. It's a very loose and scrambled movie to its betterment and detriment. It closely mirrors the subject, who is an alcoholic. It has very loose ideas and jokes and often very drunk conversations, and it kind of just meanders. And then suddenly there's a plot when he meets Liza Minnelli when she's shoplifting and he's smitten. So he's supposed to marry someone. Basically, his family has decided everything for him. That's partially why he's a drunk, because he feels he has no control over his life. And then suddenly meeting Liza Minnelli, he wants to marry her, but if he did that, he would have to give up his fortune. You know, a common thing that we all have experienced one time or another.
That's always happening to me. Ugh.
Yeah, and it's an enjoyable film, but it is very, very loose. It's kind of very interesting to watch, especially when you think of the 80s, that it doesn't have like this like plot structure that we all think of. The filmmaker himself, Steve Gordon, it was a huge hit in 1981, and he died right after it came, or right before it came out. And so he never got to seize on that success that had happened there. But someone who did was John Gielgud. He was the fourth person ever to win an EGOT.
What?
He achieved that in 1991. After he was cast as so he plays a butler in Arthur, and what? he plays Alfred in Tim Burton's Batman as well.
Oh.
So like he did become typecast, but people loved that Gielgud butler. When he won the EGOT, he was the first since Rita Moreno in 1977. So he broke the EGOT drought. It was 14 years without an EGOT.
The best that you can do, the best that you can do, is win an EGOT.
Thank you so much for listening to Best in Show. We would love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word as we get closer and closer to the BAFTAs, the Indie Spirit Awards, and the Oscars.
Follow us and our Awards HQ on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes, and drop us mailbag questions to podcast@letterboxd.com. We didn't have any in this week. We didn't have any this week. Our mailbox is a little lonely. If you have any indie spirit questions, send them our way. Thanks to our crew, Slim for the edit, Sophie for production, Trent Walton for the music, George Fenwick for newslettering, Danny Haas for the art, Julia Barrett-Mitchell for the War is Over interview, the entire Letterboxd content team for all the extra good stuff, including Ella Kemp, who is going to the BAFTAs this weekend, and Mia and Brian, who went to the Oscars luncheon, and Brian, as always, for overall producing.
And speaking of the Oscar luncheon, you will see what we did there very, very soon. And thank you to our crew who worked that, not just Mia and myself, but Carrie Barber on sound, Corey Gegner on camera, Kevin Greedwin on still camera, and Andy Lyons for production assistance. Thank you for listening. Best in Show is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.